I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Iraqi insurgents today released 10 hostages, mostly from Pakistan and Turkey, but still hold as many as two dozen, including three Japanese, seven Chinese, and an American truck driver for the Kellogg Brown and Root Company. We'll have more on that story in a moment. But first, U.S. military officials report today that two U.S. soldiers and seven additional employees of the contractor Kellogg Brown and Root are also missing. And U.S. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett said this morning that securing roads has now become a top priority in Iraq. We're joined by Nicholas Pelham in Baghdad. He writes for the Financial Times. Welcome, Nicholas.
Hi, Robin.
How are people responding there to the kidnappings? Is this seen as a new tactic in Iraq?
It certainly is, and it's seen as a very worrying one for the reconstruction process. The reconstruction process depends on contractors, by and large, Westerners who are coming to manage projects in Iraq, and the kidnapping is terrifying them. They're leaving their workplaces, they've stopped communicating with their sites, and many of them, scores upon scores, have retreated inside the Green Zone, the fortified enclave where the coalition has its headquarters.
And why is it thought that insurgents are targeting contractors rather than soldiers, for kidnappings at least?
The insurgents know that if they're going to defeat Mr. Bremer, they have to defeat his reconstruction process, and that is why contractors are being targeted.
Yeah, and you also write that contractors are seen to garner more headlines, frankly, than soldiers.
Absolutely. It's particularly noticeable that many of the security companies are being targeted. If you look at the numbers of casualties of contractors, by far and away the largest proportion are of the armed security guards who accompany foreign companies coming into Iraq.
We're also learning a lot more about who these contractors are. We read that the Chinese workers were actually freelancers who had come from a small town that's known for sending workers abroad because China, of course, has no troops and no companies in Iraq. China's now warning its people not to pick up and go look for work in Iraq. Do you have the sense that there are that many sort of, you know, freelance workers coming to Iraq to be contractors?
Most of them are seeking work before they get into Iraq. Managers who are, because of the risks involved in working in the country at the moment, managers who would perhaps get a salary of something between some $50,000 to $80,000 in their home countries can achieve at least three times that by working in Iraq. So the pay scales have mushroomed.
Yeah. And one last question. What has the response been on the part of the leadership of Iraq? We heard last week that many of the Muslim leaders were condemning the kidnapping as being against Islam. Are we hearing more about that today?
Yes, but it has to be said that hostage taking has been a practice, a tribal practice from time immemorial, and that the societies which are taking hostages are very tribal in nature. It has to be said it isn't just the tribesmen who are holding people. American soldiers and commanders have also been holding family members, most notably in the case of the former vice president of Iraq, Ibrahim Zardari, whose family was being held while the hunt went on for Mr. Zardari. So the practice of holding hostages is not that alien to the area, and it's very likely that it's going to continue.
Nicholas, thank you.
Okay, not at all.
Nicholas Pelham of the Financial Times. He spoke to us from Baghdad.
An American being held hostage in Iraq is Thomas Hamill, who's worked since last fall as a truck driver for the engineering and construction company Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a division of Halliburton. Hamill was captured Friday by insurgents who've threatened to kill him unless the U.S. withdraws its troops from Fallujah. Hamill's a former dairy farmer from Macon, Mississippi. He's married and the father of two young children. Joining us on the line now is Steve Rogers, city editor for the Commercial Dispatch in Columbus, Mississippi. He wrote about Hamill in the latest edition of the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve, what kind of a guy is Tom Hamill?
You hate to use the stereotype of he's just a good old boy, and I don't mean that negatively. He was hardworking. He'd been in the dairy business that his father and uncle had started 30 years ago. You know, he liked hunting and fishing. And cherished his family.
Yeah, a dairy farmer. Why did he decide to go to as dangerous a place as Iraq?
The dairy business, particularly for small independent dairy farmers, has been very difficult all over this country. High food prices, feed prices for his cattle, low milk prices, it got the best of him. And he just decided that he couldn't carry on and survive. The debt was piling up, and so he decided to sell the farm, sell the herd last summer.
He visited home recently, I understand, on emergency leave from Iraq to visit his wife, who'd undergone heart surgery.
She had taken emergency leave to have open heart surgery, and they allowed him to come home from Iraq for about a week.
What did he tell his neighbors when he came back for that week?
He said that, you know, it was very difficult. It took some getting used to, some, you know, obviously it's a very foreign experience for any American. But, you know, if you just worked hard and did what you were supposed to do, it certainly had lots of risk. He had some minor ambushes of convoys on a couple of occasions and had been through some artillery fire and had bricks thrown through the windshield of his truck and things like that. But it was just his nature. You know, again, he's a tough, just hardworking guy. And so to him, I think he was probably, and I think a lot of his friends think that he was probably internalizing it to minimize the risk. So I don't think his family would be upset or concerned.
Do you have any idea what a truck driver for Halliburton in Iraq makes?
One of the things here in the South that you don't talk about is your pay, among other things. And so I don't think he really disclosed that. I know what, you know, the Halliburton, when they were offering jobs, particularly last summer, the salaries would get a lot of people's attention. In particular, you know, look at the average, the median income in Noxubee County is about $22,000 or $23,000 a year. And that's the median household income. So, you know, if they were paying $80,000 or $100,000, that would be a significant boost.
What's the mood in Macon, Mississippi?
It's one of coming together. Small towns in the South, but small towns everywhere, you know, do this. People know everybody. The whole county only has 12,500 people in it. He was a lifelong resident there, went to high school there. So everybody knows everybody, and they're just coming together. I mean, black, white, Hispanic, just sort of reuniting in the spirit of hope and pulling together for their family. It's sort of like if somebody's house burns down, just only more dramatic.
Steve, is there any indication how this affects views on U.S. troops and civilians being in Iraq?
Iraq sort of became just something you saw on the news and you really didn't think about it, and it has brought it home, and I think a lot of people are thinking positively and negatively. There's a sort of a lot of undercurrent reaction in the community because, I mean, it's brought Iraq literally to these people's doorsteps in rural East Mississippi. And, you know, there are people who think they understand why he went there. Some wonder, you know, why we had to go, why it came to something like this from an economic standpoint for Thomas Hamill, that this is what he had to do to try to support his family. And there's a lot of patriotism, too. People are angry, and that manifests itself in many ways.
Steve Rogers is city editor for the Commercial Dispatch in Columbus, Mississippi. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Some of the most important witnesses yet will appear before the 9/11 Commission when public hearings resume tomorrow. Testifying will be former FBI Director Louis Freeh and his successor Robert Mueller. The former CIA head of counterterrorism will also testify, as will Bush Attorney General John Ashcroft and his Clinton administration predecessor Janet Reno. The failure of these officials and their agencies to work together to prevent terrorist attacks will be under the spotlight. For more specifics on what we should listen for, we're joined by Josh Meyer of the Los Angeles Times. Josh, start with the FBI directors. What will the commissioners be asking them?
Well, I think that they're going to come under some very heavy scrutiny for their activities over the last 8 years. In fact, Louis Freeh was the director of the FBI for one of the longest tenures in FBI history. And Robert Mueller, the new director, took over only a week before 9/11. So Mr. Freeh is going to be coming under a lot of scrutiny for his actions, particularly accusations that he made such a little priority intelligence gathering and information sharing that it really hampered the efforts of the entire FBI to fight counterterrorism.
But we saw the president's daily briefing that was released this week and mentioned 70 full-field investigations that the FBI had ongoing. What went wrong?
Well, they're not really talking right now. In fact, I tried to get them to comment several times last week for a story that I did over the weekend, and they're saying that they're going to be letting senior FBI officials who testify Tuesday and Wednesday do the talking for the Bureau. But the concern is that those investigations, the information within each one wasn't shared with the other bureaus and it wasn't shared with headquarters. There's also some concerns that headquarters itself wasn't passing the warnings of a tremendous spike in threat information in the summer of 2001 down the chain of command to the field offices. For instance, a field office agent in the Phoenix office wrote a memo called the Phoenix Memo, July 10th of 2001, in which he warned about a lot of suspicious activity on the part of Arab students taking flight training lessons. And he asked the entire FBI to sort of mobilize and look at whether there was a problem there. And that came only 5 days after Condoleezza Rice, according to her own testimony, told the FBI and her national security counterterrorism person, Richard Clark, to shake the trees and find out whatever they could about terrorism. 5 days later, this guy writes a memo, and it never even makes its way up to Washington headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Well, whose job was it to follow up on those 70 full-field investigations or the report of them in the president's daily briefing?
I think that there may be a little bit of shifting the blame from one person to another. Clearly, the head of the FBI would be responsible for that. Richard Clark, who is head of the White House Counterterrorism Security Group, also bears some responsibility. But then you also have to look at the actions of Condoleezza Rice and even the president himself in terms of saying who's responsible. I think yesterday when the president released his response to this, he said there was no specific information in the president's daily brief on August 6th that specifically said there was going to be a hijacking of a plane and using it as a weapon. But there's a lot of people now that are saying that as the president, if there wasn't a lot of specific information, why didn't he ask for more information, and why didn't he ask for a full briefing on the 70 FBI investigations and so forth? Mm. It's not clear that he didn't, but so far they've offered no information that he did.
Well, briefly, Josh, Attorney General John Ashcroft will also be testifying. Is the relationship between his Justice Department and the FBI likely to be part of the questioning?
Well, I think it will. I think that what some of the FBI officials are going to say is that they asked John Ashcroft, the incoming attorney general, for a big increase in counterterrorism funding, and that in the days right before September 11th that he had rejected that. His staff says that it's much more complicated than that, so we'll have to wait and see.
And overall, Josh, in the terrorism community, what are people saying to you about this August 6th memo? Everybody's debating it. Was it history, or should it have been something that would have set off alarm bells?
Well, I mean, as the president himself acknowledged yesterday, it's clearly not just history. I mean, it's clearly current threat information. So I think that they're going to go back and try to figure out how somebody like Condoleezza Rice can say that that was a historical document when clearly even the president now acknowledges that it wasn't. But yes, I mean, if you say that you have a suspicious pattern of activity involving hijacking of planes and 70 full-field investigations, you know, somebody dropped the ball here, and I think they're going to try to find out who it was and whether it was an institutional or structural problem or whether it was just a few people that just really didn't do what they were supposed to do. Because you have to remember, this is not just an FBI or Justice Department problem. The CIA had tremendous problems of its own. For instance, the CIA had the names of two of the hijackers and didn't pass them along to federal law enforcement agencies for 18 months. They say that if they had gotten those names, they probably would have found out that these two guys were hiding out in San Diego and making plans to participate in the hijacking plot.
In fact, they were taking flight lessons, and
right.
Did we understand that an FBI agent actually sent an email to California to look for these fellows on the 11th, and they were already on board the planes?
Their names, at least one of their names was in the San Diego phone book, and they never contacted the San Diego counterterrorism agent to tell him about it. He was in contact with an informant who knew both of these guys, and he would have been able to find them.
Hmm. Josh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer, he covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times.
Just ahead, the brief beauty of a Tibetan mandala made of sand.
And later, the songs of Robert Burns.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The poet William Blake wrote of seeing a world in a grain of sand. But for more than 1,000 years, Tibetan monks have made worlds with grains of sand. They create sand mandalas, which are brilliantly colored, intricate, circular visual odes to harmony, like tapestries woven with sand. Three monks recently created a sand mandala in an auditorium at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. 4 feet in diameter, they worked on it exhaustively for 4 days amid the constant sound of chanted prayer and the clicking and scraping of the metal instruments used to meticulously distribute the sand. And then, exquisite as the completed mandala was, they destroyed it. I visited with one of the monks while the mandala was being made.
My name is Tenzin Priyadarshi, and I'm a Buddhist monk from India, a disciple of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And currently, I'm at MIT as a Buddhist chaplain and visiting scholar here. With all this talk of war and anger everywhere, we decided to use the Buddhist way of spreading the news of compassion. So that's why we are doing the sand mandala. So when we lay down the sand grain around the map, We have to cultivate that motivation, that intention of compassion and altruism with every grain of sand laid. And especially this particular mandala is of the Buddha of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. So hoping that the news of compassion, the feeling of compassion, would radiate out from MIT.
Mandalas consist of Buddhist symbols. The center of the mandala at MIT was perhaps the ultimate Buddhist symbol, the lotus, which is among the most beautiful of flowers, but which grows only out of muddy water. I asked about the history of mandalas.
It started off in India, and then it was taken to Tibet. So the symbolism is about 2,000 years old. So for example, in the middle of the mandala, you'll see a lotus. A lotus is a representation of the bodhisattva of compassion. And lotus has many implications in Buddhism. But one of the implications is that a beautiful lotus grows out of muddied flower, but it does not disassociate itself from the muddied flower. So goodness can arise from evil as such. We do not need to separate these things completely, but there is always hope that something good will arise from something as muddy, something unclear as such. Then, for example, we have another symbol of a sword. The sword is a representation of wisdom. So you cut down through all ignorance and delusion. It's full of symbolism.
And at the end, this beautiful thing, this velvety sand, multicolored mandala, is destroyed.
Well, we won't say destroyed. We use the word dissolution. It's a world, a universe that it ought to be. So the idea that every time you create with more intensity, more energy. One of the things about permanence is when something is permanent, people don't value it that much.
As a mandala is created, along with the chanting of prayers, is a constant sound like locusts in the summer. Those are the traditional instruments used to make the mandala. A narrow metal funnel filled with sand is rubbed or tapped by a kind of thin metal prong, which vibrates the sand out of the funnel, grain by meticulous grain. And when the labor of days and sometimes weeks for larger mandalas is done, the work of sacred art is simply swept away.
So a lesson in impermanence is that impermanence, transition, is reality of our world. Things change. And then, of course, you know, when we dismantle the mandala, we take the sand to the river, hoping that the energy that was created by prayers and chanting and recitation, that energy flows with the river to wherever it goes and carries this message of peace and compassion, he says.
You'll put it in the Charles River and out to the Atlantic Ocean?
We hope so, yeah. And we hope from Atlantic to other parts of the world, yeah.
But of course, sometimes, life being so full of change and unpredictability and all that, fate does intervene.
We made the sand mandala on the floor. And the moment we finished it, the faculty came to see. And one of the female professors, she had a kid with her. And then the kid came running, crying, "Mommy." And then she tripped and she rolled over the sand mandala.
Oh,
so the monks, we were cracking out loud, you know, because it's supposed to be dismantled at the end. So we said, you know, that's great, our job is done.
That was Tenzin Priyadarshi talking about the creation and dissolution of a sand mandala at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where Tenzin is the Buddhist chaplain. Special thanks to George Hicks for production help.
And this note from the world of sports, as one scribe wrote this morning, in golf, this is as good as it gets. The last hole, the leaders tied, the man on the green, a perennial, also ran. The putt, the kind a Broadway musical could be written about. An 18-footer that hung on the edge of the cup, just hung there, as the gallery and the golfer held their collective breath. Then it circled and dropped in. And Phil Mickelson overcame 12 years of third-place finishes to win the Masters yesterday in Augusta, Georgia, his first major title after 43 tries. When his birdie sank on the 18th, the crowd exploded in joy and, I think, relief. Even those of us who don't know a thing about golf knew enough to know we couldn't bear it if it didn't go in.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Louis Free, the former head of the FBI, is questioned by the 9/11 Commission. We'll have excerpts and analysis.
And we talk with actress Helen Mirren, who returns to her Emmy-winning role as Jane Tennyson in the series Prime Suspect. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush's favorability ratings are at the lowest point of his presidency, according to a weekend Newsweek poll. And were the presidential election held now, presumptive Democratic nominee John Kerry would defeat Bush by 7 points. But is this a momentary dip after weeks of violence in Iraq and controversy around the 9/11 Commission hearings, or does this indicate a deeper problem for the president? These ratings, after all, come after the best economic news in months, maybe years. 300,000 new jobs in March. So where's the positive bump for the president? Well, joining us on the line are Bill Douglas, White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
And Andrea Stone, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
Bill Douglas, the White House released over the weekend the text of that presidential daily briefing Bush received on his Crawford, Texas ranch August 6, 2001. That's the PDB warning of attacks by bin Laden in the United States, which was featured so prominently in the Condoleezza Rice hearings last week. What do you make of the president's repeated assertion that if he'd known a time and a place of a planned attack on the U.S., he would have moved mountains, he said, to prevent it?
It's a good cover. And it won't satisfy critics. Critics will say it is disingenuous. But the critics could also say that this memo indicates that something was up.
Yeah, you know, I was talking yesterday to a counterterrorism expert. He was saying that, you know, you never have, you know, time, date, place, what the event will be. You know, and usually you have that after the event happens. So it's not unusual to have very vague warnings with no real specifics.
And we had prior to these hearings and shortly after 9/11, there was discussion of increased chatter. So there was, they knew there was some activity going on. They just didn't know what it was.
And I think this week, you know, the heads of the FBI and the Justice Department, former and current, are going to be before the commission. And one of the things that was in that PDB was an allusion to 70 ongoing field investigations that the FBI was doing. And the question is, well, if they were doing 70 investigations, why couldn't they find this plot? So I think you'll see John Ashcroft and Louis Free, the former director of the FBI, as well as Bob Mueller, the current director, and also former Attorney General Janet Reno, will all be on the hot seat this week. And I think there's going to be a lot of questions about, well, what the heck was the FBI doing that summer?
What do you make, Bill, of the president's Newsweek poll ratings this weekend?
It's a bad time for the president right now, but I don't think it's a it's a permanent situation. He has said he's a wartime president, and now you have all these questions about his stewardship. So that's bound to eat into his poll numbers.
At the same time, Andrea, when Louis Freeh, the former FBI chief, and the current Attorney General John Ashcroft appear at the hearings tomorrow, that may deflect some attention from the president, might it not? We will go back to the initial problem for so many in all this, that the FBI and the CIA were not connecting the dots.
Sure, they're going to try and, you know, pin it on down the chain of command, but as Harry Truman once said, the buck stops here at the White House. So I'm not sure how successful that will be. And just to kind of follow up, you know, it's interesting. Last week, John Kerry made what he billed as a major economic address, and it got hardly any attention because of this uprising in Iraq. You know, one week we think on Election Day that the voters are going to be voting on the economy. The next week it's the Iraq. I think it's getting to look more and more like Iraq. One of the news magazines this week had a cover story comparing it to Vietnam. You don't want, you know, the situation in Iraq to be compared to Vietnam if you're George Bush.
Bill, the Washington Post, let's switch our focus a little to the visit this week of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to the Crawford Ranch, where President Bush is. The Washington Post calls Mubarak the largest obstacle to President Bush's democracy initiative in the Middle East. They say he's an autocrat. What's he doing at the ranch at a time when we're trying to bring democracy to Iraq? Your thoughts?
We need friends. And this administration right now does need some help in the Middle East, and they're probably going to ask some favors of Mubarak if Mubarak can give them.
It's interesting, you know, Mubarak is what passes for a moderate in the Middle East, and he's certainly not that. Another leader who you might say is really more of a moderate, King Abdullah of Jordan, is going to be meeting with the president next week. But the administration doesn't have a lot of choices. They said they were going to Iraq to plant the seeds of democracy that would grow and spread throughout the Middle East, and it hasn't. They have to get the situation in Iraq under control before they can think about spreading democracy to other Arab countries.
The leader of the one democracy in the Middle East, Israel, will also be visiting with the president this week, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Bill, how concerned should Bush be about Prime Minister Sharon creating facts on the ground? Sharon wants to pull out of Gaza, but it looks increasingly like negotiations over the West Bank are dead. Israel's walling itself in, which could mean, some say, confiscating, in effect, as much as 15% of the West Bank.
They're concerned, but they're also boxed in. I mean, the president has cast his lot, for better or for worse, with Ariel Sharon. Sharon has couched his actions as part of a war on terror, which the United States should understand since it's conducting its own. So there's not much Bush can do publicly. Privately, he can ask Sharon to either slow things down or reconsider the wall, which they have done in the past with no results.
I think there's also, you know, a matter of preoccupation with Iraq. So that sort of leaves Israel to kind of fend on its own. And also Afghanistan, for that matter. Remember that place. Things are really breaking down in Afghanistan, and critics are saying that it's because the resources and attention were pulled out of there and sent to Iraq. So I think, you know, the administration has a lot on its plate right now. So it's very unsettled. I don't think the administration is paying a whole lot of attention to Israel, despite the fact we have these leaders coming to Crawford this week.
And I think that in large part is why Tony Blair's visit will be important, because Blair has consistently told the administration it has to pay attention to the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
As Blair comes to Washington, that's a problem for the relationship, isn't it? Because Blair has a very different attitude toward the Sharon government than the Bush administration does.
It's been a division. I mean, they have disagreed almost from the start over the approach to the Middle East. Blair has always believed that you cannot solve the problems with Afghanistan, you cannot solve the problems in Iraq without paying attention to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. And he has felt the administration has not given it full attention to that situation. And I'm sure he will be reminding them of that when he comes and visits.
Andrew, just to finish up, any predictions for this week?
Yeah, I think the 911 commission is going to be very interesting with the justice and FBI people. I think it's also going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in Iraq if they can end the situation in Fallujah, which has really been very, very bloody, and also what's going on in the south with the Shia uprising. I think those are going to be the two main things to watch this week.
Bill?
The Bush-Blair meeting this Friday. Beyond the Palestinian-Israeli situation, there's this smattering of disagreement over Iraq. I mean, Blair has come out and reaffirmed his support with the U.S. on Iraq. But within his own party and within the Conservative Party, there's a desire for Great Britain to have a greater say in Iraq, and I'm sure that will be a topic of discussion.
Bill Douglas is White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Andrea Stone is Washington correspondent for USA Today. Andrea, thanks as always.
Thank you, Bill.
Still to come, Robert Burns, poet-songwriter, reinterpreted.
You're listening to Here and Now. The scandals at corporations like Enron, Tyco, and WorldCom have drawn a great deal of attention to what executives are paid. Those cases of CEOs making millions, even tens of millions, at the same time their companies are failing and the value of shareholders' stock is plunging. But in the wake of outrage over all that, how much has really changed? The Wall Street Journal has published a special report today looking at the issue of executive compensation. And joining us on the line from New York City is Joanne Lublin, who is the contributing editor for the report. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you.
Joanne, in the article, you write about a term called politically correct pay. What's that?
That's the idea that boards don't want to be caught embarrassed again at being held up for ridicule over the types of pay and the level of pay they're giving CEOs.
Mm-hmm.
One example would be these huge goodbye packages that CEOs often get on the way out the door after they've screwed up.
Sure.
There's a lot of effort to try and rein in those.
Well, give me an example of politically correct pay.
Well, politically correct pay would be you get paid until the day you quit, which is what the rest of us working Joes have to look forward to for the most part, and nothing beyond that, especially if you're leaving for performance reasons.
Wow, that could really shake the corporate boardroom, huh?
Definitely. Another thing that they're trying to change is this whole idea that you need to shower new CEOs or newly promoted CEOs with gazillion stock options and tremendous numbers of restricted stock. Things are called mega grants. Our study showed that those have definitely dropped in popularity.
What is driving this? Is it shareholders? Simple as that?
I think it's mainly the embarrassment factor. People who are on boards, particularly on the compensation committees, don't want to be held up for ridicule, and they are asking tougher questions. If we pay Joe X, how much will he make in the year 2010? So they don't want to just know what it's going to cost shareholders today, but what's it going to cost shareholders tomorrow?
Is it fundamentally linking performance more to what you get paid, like the rest of us average Joes out there, as you put it?
Well, except the mantra of, you know, pay for performance has been there for years. The problem is that they've always tended to rewrite the rules after the fact. We tried hard, therefore we should still give the guy some money for trying hard. I think that now the mantra is going to become pay only for super performance.
Will it make a real difference, do you think, in the long run to what chief executive officers are paid?
I think a confluence of factors will have that impact, not just the fact that board members are worried about being embarrassed. You also have the fact that stock options pretty soon are going to be charged against earnings, and so options are also falling out of favor. That's what drove a lot of these huge packages. The problem is whether this actually makes a difference in the level of CEO pay is not going to be evident for at least a couple of years because they kind of need to shake out their pockets from all that other options that have been gaining money over the past few years.
And as the public's attention perhaps drifts away from the kind of scandals we've seen in the past couple of years, one imagines that maybe the fine print could favor CEOs once again.
Absolutely. And in fact, you always have the danger here that in trying to have good optics, that it becomes kind of a smoke and mirrors. So, for instance, you have one company where they took away the use of the corporate jet, but they gave the CEO simply more salary. So you always have to worry about, you know, what's under the little cups.
Joanne Lublin, thanks very much.
You're welcome. I'm happy to help.
Joanne Lublin is the management news editor for The Wall Street Journal.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Of all the long, weird trips that pop singers take these days, Scottish singer Eddie Reader has taken one of the weirdest. From raging punker in the band Gang of Four to sleek backup singer with the Eurythmics and now balladeer, interpreting the works of 18th century poet Robert Burns. Here Now folk music reviewer Scott Alaric is here now to tell us why he thinks Reader's modern path runs parallel to the ones Burns traveled, what, over 200 years ago. Hi, Scott.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Robin.
This is so fascinating. We're going to hear a little bit about Robert Burns and about Eddie Reader. Start with her first. Who is she?
Well, today she's one of the most respected folk pop singers in Europe with a big cult following and a reputation as a real singer's singer, a supreme stylist. But this is how the world first heard her, and you can barely hear her at all, backing the post-punk band Gang of Four in the early 80s. And here she is today on her gorgeous new CD of songs by Robert Burns.
And I shall love thee still, my dear, though the sands of life shall run. But fare thee well, my only love, and fare thee well.
Eddie Reader interpreting Robert Burns' My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, one of the few poems of his that I have committed to memory. Listeners might have as well.
Ah.
What a beautiful song.
Oh, yeah, and what a beautiful singer.
So how did this happen? Tell us, how did she go from punk to this beautiful balladeer?
Well, it was amazing, Robin. As I was following this, that I didn't want to torture it too much, but the comparisons are really there between her and Burns. First of all, of course, they're both Scottish. And like Burns, her first love was Scottish traditional music. But she looked around and she saw no future in that. How can I become a Scottish traditional singer in the 1980s? So she embraced the hip popular culture of her time, went to London, started playing with punk bands. She told me often just in return for accommodations, you know, for a place to stay. And one night she was playing with a band. She doesn't remember the name of the band, only that the bass player's floor was hard. And Annie Lennox of the Eurythmics heard her and was looking for a replacement backup singer for that crucial harmonic vocal sound of the Eurythmics. So here's Eddie Reader with Annie Lennox and the Eurythmics, 1983, a live cut, and this is the kind of music she was making.
So hers is the higher backup voice there.
Yeah.
Eddie Reader's is.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're saying is the balladeer was there all along. It just went through all these other permutations.
Right. Well, like Reader, Robert Burns saw no way to make a living indulging his passion for Scottish folk music. So he rose to fame writing these sly, sexy, very modern Scottish dialect poems, but also the very anglicized romantic poetry of the day, and became the toast of London society at a time when the poets were really the rock stars of the day. Had the chance at a very prosperous career and was even offered a chance for Parliament, but turned it all down to return to Scotland and devote his life to the two loves he had then, Scottish traditional music and a woman named Jean Armour. It's very similar to the way Reader became disenchanted with the pop culture of her day. She told me the rock world then seemed to be all about smoke machines, makeup, and very large shoulder pads. So she began putting out her own smart folk pop records and championing songwriters like Boo Hewerdine. Here's a sample of the way she sounds now. Very acoustic, but you can hear the techno-pop sleekness that she brought over from the Eurythmics. And this song really also captures her feelings about the years she spent chasing pop stardom, comparing herself to a hummingbird, all that work and worry just to stand still.
Hummingbird, hummingbird. Hummingbird, hummingbird, always on let you down. You never reach the sky and you cannot touch the ground. Soar, you will never soar. Spin or swoop or glide. Soar, up above us all. In the shadows, you must hide. Hummingbird, so you beat your wings. If you forget to sing, you lose your song. Then where will you go when all the pretty things have gone?
Again, Eddie Reader singing, but we've been talking also about Robert Burns and his writing. How else did they parallel?
Well, I think this gets to the most important way, Robin. Burns had become a star in his day, and he knew what that meant, and he knew how to use it. So when he began devoting himself to Scottish traditional music, he ended up writing something like 326 songs, collected hundreds more, and he said that when he set his poems to a Scottish melody, it gave it two chances to survive as a fiddle tune and as a Robert Burns poem. He knew that they would publish Robert Burns, in other words. So if he put his poetry to all of this great music, it would get saved, it would get passed along. And he ended up spending the rest of his life devoted to popularizing Scottish traditional music that way.
And let's remind ourselves of a little Robert Burns, shall we? Man's inhumanity to man, one of his quotes, let us do or die, and Auld Lang Syne.
Yes, he wrote Auld Lang Syne. Yes.
So he's familiar to you, even if you're not sure if he's familiar to you. And now we'll be even more so because of Eddie Reader.
Should auld acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should auld acquaintance be forgot and days of old? For Auld Lang Syne, my dear, for Auld Lang Syne, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for the sake of Auld Lang Syne.
And I think Reader really took a cue from Robert Burns in the way she approached this homage to his songs. A lot of times when people do tributes like this, they can smother the work with reverence, you know, and do it just so tender that it doesn't come to life. But she really gets that Robert Burns was bringing this stuff to life. He revived this music by letting it breathe the modern air of his time. And that's exactly what she's doing. In fact, Reader told me that this was where she felt the most kinship with Robert Burns. She told me he wanted to communicate what he loved about this music and to use the tools at hand to draw people in. I definitely relate to that. So she sings these old songs as if they happened to her yesterday, and she's not afraid to give them a little modern groove. And in that, she's become part of the same process that seduced Burns, melding the best of the old to the best of the new, which is really the difference between something that's just old and something that's timeless. And it's exactly why the songs of Robert Burns can still mean so much to us today.
Well, Scott, I'd like to hear one more sample of Eddie Reader channeling Robert Burns. What should we listen to?
There she is. She brings it all together here in the song, Jamie, Come Try Me.
If thou would be my love, if thou would kiss me, Lord, if thou would be my love, Jamie, come try me.
Here now, folk music critic Scott Alaric on the new CD, Eddie Reader Sings the Songs of Robert Burns. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Special thanks and happy trails to our intern, Ed Walters.
Absolutely. Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.